Well, it is a privilege and a pleasure to be with you today. As some of you know, I was baptized at Grace Bible. I was mentored by John at Grace Bible. So I have very fond memories of Grace Bible, and coming to Grace is like coming home. Thinking about our text for today, I was getting a little nostalgic thinking about grace. And I was reminded of a very famous line from a very popular story that I grew up with. You might be familiar with it. It's called The Princess Bride. It's a quaint little tale. You have the actor that plays Columbo, and he's the grandfather telling a story to the Wonder Years kid. And in that story, the villain's henchmen have captured the princess, and they're fleeing with her, and they're being pursued by the hero of the story. And they're constantly trying to throw obstacles in his path, and the hero is one by one overcoming these obstacles. And the leader of the henchmen is watching this, and every time the hero succeeds, he says, "This is inconceivable! Inconceivable!" And eventually, one of his underlings turns to him and says, "You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means." There are scenes in the Gospels that are misquoted. There are scenes in the Gospels that are misused. There are scenes in the Gospels that are misunderstood. And then there is the scene that we will cover in our time together today. It is a familiar story, one that sinners like to keep in mind. It's kind of like their little Uno reverse card. So anytime a godly person tries to shed light on their misbehavior, well, they can pull it out and say, aha. But we may discover today that their attempt at misdirection is really quite mistaken. Because in reality, they are quite misinformed concerning this text. You see, they keep using this text, but it does not mean what they think it means. And so, much like the folks that will appear in our text today, if they continue going down the road that they're on, they're going to end up getting what they deserve. Our text today will be John chapter 8. So if you'll meet me in John chapter 8. Each gospel writer had their own literary agenda, their own contribution that they thought was important enough to take a break from spreading the news about Jesus, to sit down and put pen to page. In Matthew's gospel, the reader is one who needs righteousness. And so he introduces the reader to Jesus, the righteousness of God in a man. In John's gospel, the reader is one who needs life. And so John is going to introduce his reader to Jesus, the life of God in a man. In him is the life, and the life is the light of men. Now, whoever has the Son has this life. Whoever believes in him shall not perish, but shall have everlasting life. He has the words of life. He is the bread of life. He gives the light of life. He offers abundant life. You know, the variety that goes on and on. So if length of days and years of life and peace, the thing that you so desperately need, if you're looking for that, all of that is found in him. And that's why John wrote his gospel, including very particular signs, very particular evidences, so that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that by believing, we might have life in his name. He is the one that the Old Testament anticipated. He is the Psalm 2 King of Israel. And you can stake your life on him. Now, the plot of John is carried along by various feasts in Jerusalem. And in chapter 7, Jesus visits the city to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. It's a feast that remembered Israel's wandering in the wilderness. And while the people were remembering the water that Moses provided to sustain them for that 40-year period, Jesus presents himself as the greater Moses, the one who comes that can quench their thirst. He offers living water. He supplies the Spirit without measure. And while the crowds were coming to him, the religious leaders hear what he's saying, and they begin coming at him. They want to silence him. They want to seize him. They want to prevent the people from following him. But Jesus remained untouchable because his hour had not yet come. He was in control of the plot. The Father has his itinerary, and Jesus is going to follow it to the T. Now, our portion today is going to come right on the heels of that encounter at the Feast of Tabernacles. Pick it up with me, if you will. We are going to start in the final verse of John 7, verse 53. Everyone went to his home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people were coming to him. And he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery. And having set her in the center of the court, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery, in the very act. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say?" And they were saying this, testing him, so that they might have grounds for accusing him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground. But when they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And when they heard it, they began to go out, one by one, beginning with the older ones. And he was left alone, and the woman, where she was, in the center of the court. Straightening up, Jesus said to her, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "I do not condemn you either. Go. From now on, sin no more." Now, before we dig into the text, depending on your Bible, you may have noticed that our portion for today is encapsulated in brackets. Now, you might see one if you look back at chapter 7, verse 53, right at the beginning there. And then you might see another one at the end of chapter 8, verse 11, right after Jesus' instruction to sin no more. There we have it. What is that all about? Well, it might interest you to know that this passage does not appear in some of our oldest and some of our best manuscripts. And because of that, many have speculated that this passage might not be original to John. That someone might have come along later and just snuck it into the text. They said, "I've got a story that's got to be included here. Or I have an agenda that needs to be pushed and I need some validation for it." And they say, you know, someone just snuck it in later. In fact, the translation of my school, Dallas Theological Seminary, some of our professors have translated the NET Bible. And in that, it has an extensive note informing us that among modern commentators and textual critics, it is a foregone conclusion that the scene is not original, but represents a later addition to the text of John's Gospel. Or another one might say, I think of Bruce Metzger, who I happen to like a lot, but he says, "The evidence for non-Johannine origin of the pericope of the adulteress is overwhelming." He says it's not original. John didn't write it. And to their credit, I do think that the Pharisees' challenge in chapter 7, verse 52, "Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee," I think that we could find an appropriate answer to that claim coming from the lips of Jesus if the following verse to that was chapter 8, verse 12. I am the light of the world, and he who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. If that was the next verse, then what would be taking place is while the Pharisees were arguing amongst themselves, and Nicodemus, a character among them that we were introduced in chapter 3, that's kind of tracking, he's kind of following along, he recognizes Jesus is from God, and he's putting the pieces together, and he's trying to stand up for the possibility that Jesus might be from God, and they're saying, you don't know what you're talking about. Jesus would be inserting himself into that discussion and saying, no prophet arises from Galilee. In the scriptures, we're not anticipating that. How about Isaiah 9? That those who walk in darkness will see a great light. You know, in the land of Galilee, in the land of the Gentiles, a light will shine. How about that? How about that evidence from the scripture? So I see that. I think of that. It is possible that our passage found its way in later, but I'm not so sure. And part of the reason that I'm hesitant to follow the bandwagon is literary. You see, there are repeated stylistic interjections throughout John's gospel. Little explanations that he just sprinkles throughout his story. We don't see them in the other gospels, but John has a bunch of them. And he does it in a very particular way. He uses a conjunction, like a day. You don't see it in this text, but it's there. Just a now. And aside, okay, now I'm stepping aside and I'm explaining something, now, and then it's followed by a demonstrative, you know, now this, and then you'll have some form of the verb to speak, you know, lego, some form of the verb. So now this he said, so you're following along in John's story, I'm following the plot, I'm following the scene, and then he just pulls you right out of the scene. Now this is what's going on, dear viewer. Okay, now get back into the story. That's what John does. So I think of this, for example, in chapter 6, verse 6, we read, this he was saying to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do, referring to Jesus setting up Philip for this amazing sign he's about to perform. I think of chapter 7, verse 39. Where we read, but this he spoke of the Spirit, whom those who believe in him were to receive. Or I think of chapter 12, verse 33, where you will find it saying, but he was saying this to indicate the kind of death which he was to die. There is this stylistic marker. You find it all throughout John. Many scholars overlook it. They have not recognized it, though some have written on it. But we find an example of it right in the middle of this scene in chapter 8, verse 6. So I see that there is literary warrant. There's also contextual warrant. You know, since the occasion seems to fit with the religious rulers' need to demonstrate to the crowds that they were wrong about Jesus. They'd come to the wrong conclusion about who Jesus was. They were following after someone who was a false teacher, false Messiah. As you probably recall, at the beginning of John's gospel, the baptisms being performed by John the Baptist draws the attention of the religious rulers. And the Pharisees actually send the Levites out, the people that would know about washings, they send them out to John. Say, what are you doing? You know, who do you think you are? Who are you claiming to be? And we'll find that he answered in the first chapter, verse 20 and 21, concerning three distinct possibilities. In verse 19, these Levites say, who are you? John the Baptist confessed and did not deny, we read, but he confessed, I am not the Christ. They asked him, what then? Are you Elijah? And he said, I am not. Are you the prophet? And he answered, no. In John's view of what his ministry is about, he is not the Christ. He is not the Psalm 2 king who comes to remove Rome, restore the kingdom to Israel, and rule the nations in righteousness. That is not who he's claiming to be. He also says he is not Elijah. He's not the Malachi 4 prophet who comes to restore the hearts of the fathers to their sons before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. That's not how he is envisioning what he's doing. But then he says, he's not the prophet. Who is the prophet? In Deuteronomy chapter 18, we find the Lord letting Moses know in verse 18 of chapter 18 that in the future he intends to raise up a prophet from among Israel like Moses. And he'll put his words in his mouth, and he will speak to the people all that the Lord commands him. And it shall come about that whoever will not listen to the Lord's words, which this prophet will speak in his name, the Lord himself will require it of that one. So the prophet, this character, is a Moses-like figure that is going to arise. And interestingly enough, at the end of Deuteronomy, you have this little addition that an editor at some point in time came and added to the text. Many think it may have been Ezra. Most think that it was likely included after the exile. But it says in Deuteronomy 34, verse 9, Joshua takes over. The son of Nun was filled with the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him, and the sons of Israel listened to him and did as the Lord commanded Moses. But notice this. Verse 10, since that time, no prophet has arisen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. For all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh, all his servants and all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. So they were looking for him. They were anticipating him. They're waiting for the arrival of this one. And in John's gospel, Jesus has been presenting himself as the prophet like Moses. The one who would come and perform miracles like Moses. The one who would have a Moses-like relationship with God. Who would lead Israel on a new exodus, out from under the bondage of Rome, the new Egypt. And Jesus shows up on the scene. What is he doing? He's doing greater than Moses' miracles. Moses turns water to blood, the curse. Jesus turns water to wine, the blessing, the kingdom. Moses parts the sea and walks through on dry land. Jesus just walks straight on the water. Moses asked God to provide bread to feed the multitudes in the wilderness. Jesus personally multiplies bread to feed multitudes. Moses drew water from the rock, and Jesus claims to be the rock which provides living water. And some who are in the crowds, they got what he was saying. They're catching it. They're picking up on it. They understand it, which is why we read in chapter 7, verse 40, that when the people heard these words, they were saying, this certainly is the prophet. Now, it was far from unanimous. You find others, verse 41, who were saying, this is the Christ. Who's right? Both of them. But there are also others who were contesting that. They're saying he is not the prophet. And among them were their religious rulers who were saying in verse 49, this crowd, which does not know the law, is accursed. He's not the prophet. They do not know what they're talking about. And the reason they think that is because they don't know the Old Testament. That's their problem. They can't put this thing together. This crowd is accursed. Because they don't recognize that Jesus is a false prophet. They're following a false prophet. He wasn't sent from God. But the problem that faced the religious rulers is they had to prove that. Jesus was very persuasive. His words and his works were matching the Old Testament. So they're having to prove it. And this test that they're bringing forward in chapter 8 is an attempt to demonstrate that. Nobody can deny that Jesus does signs. I mean, he really is able to heal the lame. He really did give sight to the blind man. Nobody denies that. In fact, you might find it interesting that in the collection of rabbinic writings we know of as the Talmud, you find Jesus mentioned there. And even in there, they do not deny that Jesus performed great miracles. What do they deny? That he was doing them on behalf of God. They say that he was a sorcerer. He's performing deceiving signs. He does signs. He was just not from God. He's a false prophet. And that is where the Pharisees are right now. They cannot deny his works. So they go after his words. You might recall, we just looked at it in Deuteronomy 18:18. The standard of this prophet who was coming is one who will have the words of God in his mouth. He will speak all that the Father commanded him. So whoever doesn't listen to his words, that's why God will judge that one, is because the words of this messenger are the words of God. He comes to speak the very words of God. So if Jesus' words don't agree with Moses, false prophet. False prophet. In fact, that's exactly what the law of Moses says. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, we find the standard for a prophet. How do you know if a prophet that comes is a prophet from God? Maybe he's a prophet from Baal. James and Jambres in Egypt, they were doing miraculous signs. They could keep up with Moses for a little bit. You know, their staffs could become snakes. They could do that. They could add to Moses' judgment on Egypt, turn water to blood. Yeah, we can do that. And Pharaoh's saying, why do I keep you guys around? You're not making things any better. If I look at Deuteronomy chapter 13, we find the standard for a prophet of God. Listen to it. Deuteronomy 13, verse 1. If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true. Translation, your experience is validated. He does a miracle in your sight. Something crazy. Something supernatural. If a prophet or dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, I'm going to do this. I'm going to turn the clock back. I'm going to make the shadow go down steps. I'm going to interrupt your normal understanding of the natural order. Calls down fire from heaven. If a prophet or dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true, concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, whom you have not known, and let us serve them. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall follow the Lord your God and fear him, and you shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him and cling to him. But that prophet or dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he has counseled rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, to seduce you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you. The standard of a true prophet is not merely that they can do crazy things. The standard of a true prophet is, do their words perfectly align with the word of God that preceded it? Are their words in perfect agreement with the Old Testament, with Moses and the prophets? That is the standard. In fact, Jesus will bring that up. It's neither here nor there. But Matthew 7, Beware of the wolves that will come to you in sheep's clothing, the false prophets. What does a wolf in sheep's clothing look like? A sheep. You cannot tell the difference by their appearance. You cannot tell the difference by the things that they do. I know that's how we often take that. That's not what he's talking about. In fact, if you follow that text along, you will find, he will say that you will know them by their fruits. By which he means, oh, well, we say their works sometimes, don't we? But wait, the false prophet looks like a sheep. He looks like a sheep, y'all. You keep reading and they got all kinds of crazy, better works than I got. Anybody in here doing many miracles in Jesus' name? Casting out demons? The ones in Matthew 7 are. They're doing crazy things. And what does the Lord say? Depart from me, I never knew you. Because the fruits in Matthew 7 are not their works, it's their words. A discussion Jesus will pick up in chapter 12. By your words you'll be justified. By your words you will be condemned. What is it that you say? Because your words, that which comes out of the mouth, is really that which filled the heart. Now, I can't know your heart until you start talking. You can do all kinds of stuff. You can go have a ministry for orphans and widows. That's great. But why are you doing that? Well, then you get to talking. Now I know. Now your character is revealed. That's why the law was supposed to be on their heart. That's the Shema. Hear, O Israel. Right? This law is to be on your heart, and you are to talk about it. When you're rolling around, hanging out with the kids, whatever you put your hand to. It's to be made your character. Now when the prophet comes, that's who he's supposed to be. That's what the testing of Jesus is about in Matthew 4. This is my beloved son. Listen to this guy. Goes into the wilderness, like Israel, 40 days, not 40 years, to be not tempted, tested. Same word, different slant. Tested. Why? Because a test reveals something about you. It shows something that's already true about you. And how does Jesus answer? From the law. The law is on his heart. That's the point. So I look here, they're saying, we're going to get him by his words. If we show that his words contradict Moses, he is a false prophet. I don't care what he does. I don't care if he calls down fire from heaven. There's one coming, by the way, if you didn't know, who can do that, who's not from God. The same author that penned this gospel pens Revelation, and he'll tell you all about that. So it's not what they do. He looks like a lamb. He speaks like a dragon, a serpent. It's what they say. Their words reveal their heart. So they're going to catch Jesus in his words. So, regarding the inclusion of this text in John 8, there is literary warrant. There is contextual warrant. We could go into how it connects the flow. There are answers in the following scene that you won't be set up for unless this scene is in there. But I won't spoil that for you yet. It's also what we might call the more difficult reading. That is, there is no good reason for implanting this scene into the text. And there is every reason to omit it from the text. You know, the early church was not like us. They are not looking for an excuse for adultery. They're not looking for some way to make adultery an approvable thing in society. They're not doing that. So when I come to this and I look at a text that would be embarrassing for them. It's embarrassing for those who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus to have this situation. I think I can understand why it would be excluded, but I can't quite wrap my brain around who would be including this in the text. There are all kinds of situations you'll come across. You know, text critical work is kind of like Sherlock Holmes. You're trying to piece together the story, and you'll find sometimes some scribes just try to help the biblical authors along every now and then. Let me help you along here when something's embarrassing. I think in Judges 18, you find Jonathan, who is a grandson of Moses, the one who led Israel out of Egypt, is now the one who's leading Israel into apostasy. And boy, is that embarrassing. How can this be? So they make it, well, is it Moses or is it Manasseh? Whoa, see, it's Manasseh. No. Moses. Manasseh's not a Levite. You can't do it. It's Moses. So there's little additions like that. And I can think of some texts where you think of the end of Mark. Some scribes didn't think Mark had a fitting ending. There's still a debate on this, but I can, whether or not, whatever you think about the ending of Mark from verse 9 onward, they said, we need to talk a little bit about Jesus' resurrection. Okay, let's have a fitting ending to this gospel. I can at least understand why they might do that. Why would someone insert this passage into John? If you can't answer that, you can't convince me for why I should remove it. I'm not like Thomas Jefferson. I'm not going to be quick about chopping this Bible up. If you've got a scene, it's not like it's just a word that could have been misunderstood. This is a significant scene. We need excellent warrant, not just external. I need internal warrant. I need to know why to remove it. So I am going to treat it as original today. Now, if we're looking at the text, chapter 7, verse 53, it tells us that the Feast of Tabernacles has ended. Everybody went home, as opposed to their little shacks, their little booths that they were living in for the past week. Everybody, that is, except Jesus. Jesus goes to the Mount of Olives, which is interesting. I mean, that's where, if you know the Old Testament, you would expect him to return from the Mount of Olives. I'm thinking Zechariah 14 in the eschaton, which also has something to say about the Feast of Booths, by the way, but that's neither here nor there. But Jesus goes to the Mount of Olives. He comes back to the temple the next day. The crowds are coming to him. They're waiting on him. The religious rulers are looking for him because they got a plan. They've gotten hold of an adulterous woman. And they bring her and they put her before Jesus and the crowds. It's in the sight of everybody, so everybody can see what's going on. And this wasn't someone who is merely accused of committing adultery. Right, this wasn't someone who was suspected that maybe they're committing adultery. They hadn't been coming home from work. You know, they've been pulling late hours. Maybe something's going. That's not the situation. It's not someone who might have committed adultery in the past. It's someone who, verse 4, was caught in the act. Translation? This isn't a matter of reasonable doubt. She was caught red-handed. She's guilty. There's no debating her guilt. That's not the question. You say, okay. What then is the question? Notice it. Verse 5. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say, Jesus? That is the question. The Pharisees are appealing to the law. They've brought the scribes with them. Interestingly, this is the only place in John the scribes are mentioned. They are the experts in the law. Now, the Pharisees brought the experts in case they need to appeal to authority, in case they need expert testimony on the stand. What do the scribes say? There it is. And they say, teacher, Moses said this. Now, do you agree with Moses or not? You know, we understand that you're all about mercy, Jesus. You know, you'll step all over the Sabbath to show mercy to someone. We know that. I mean, in fact, as you recall, that is the key contention between the religious rulers of the day and Jesus. He performs the right signs. He's just doing them at the wrong time. Sure, he heals the lame, but he does it on the Sabbath. So he's a false prophet. And therefore, no sign that he does can validate who he is. So for him to, because if Jesus was right, that would mean their tradition is wrong. For him to be right, they'd have to be wrong about the Sabbath. And they're not willing to consider that. So it doesn't matter what he says. That is the blasphemy of the Spirit. The signs are attributed to Satan. You've got to have some kind of an answer for why his signs are invalid. This is it. He breaks the Sabbath, false prophet. And so they'll say, look, you step all over the Sabbath. You're willing to do that to show mercy. Are you going to step on Moses too? You're going to tell us to show this adulterous woman mercy. See, look at verse 6. They were saying this, testing him, so that they might have grounds for accusing him. They wanted to put Jesus on trial. They wanted to condemn Jesus. But to do that, they need an occasion. They need some charges that would stick. Now notice how Jesus responds. Verse 6 again. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger he wrote on the ground. But when they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." What does that mean? What is Jesus saying? I did a Google search for the phrase, "let him cast the first stone," and Google supplied me with a definitive explanation of the phrase from Wiktionary.org, which is as follows. Only those who are faultless have the right to pass judgment upon others, implying that no one is faultless and that therefore no one has such a right to pass judgment. And that's pretty standard fare for how this text is treated. Perhaps that's the way that you might have understood how this text should be treated. You know, that you're not perfect, so you don't have the right to judge someone else for not being perfect. But if that's what Jesus is saying, then wouldn't he be contradicting Moses? I mean, after all, the Pharisees said, "Moses commanded us to stone such women." Were they wrong? Listen to this. We'll allow Moses to testify himself. This is Deuteronomy 22. If I'm in Deuteronomy 22, and I look at verse 22, I read, "If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel." Furthermore, Moses also says, "If there is a girl who is a virgin engaged to a man, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you." And that sounds pretty straightforward to me. I mean, it's just an open and shut case. In fact, you know, there are all kinds of infractions in the Old Covenant that required a response from the civil authorities. And they obviously were carrying these things out. And the crime of adultery, I mean, that's not some obscure matter. That's not Commandment 612 way out there. This is one of the Ten Commandments. Number 7, to be exact, Exodus 20:14. "Thou shalt not commit adultery." So if Jesus is advocating that such matters should only be adjudicated by a perfect judge, then he's saying exactly what the Pharisees expected and wanted him to say. He is contradicting Moses. And yet, in our text, notice their response. Verse 9. When they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones. And he was left alone, and the woman where she was in the center of the court. If Jesus gave them the answer they were looking for, then why don't they give us the answer that we expect? If Jesus gave them the answer they were looking for, why don't they give us the answer that we expect? Instead of saying, you know, "Aha, see, false prophet." Why do they just leave? Why do they appear to leave quickly? You know, they tuck their tails between their legs and they're getting out of Dodge. Why? And why do the older ones go before the younger ones? Well, First, let's look at a little detail that the text records for us. Notice in verse 6, Jesus, in response to their question, stoops down and with his finger, he wrote on the ground. And again, I read it in verse 8. Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Now, it's not the writing per se that's going to cause the response from the Pharisees. How do I know that? Verse 9, when they heard it, when they heard what he said, now it's time to leave. So it's not necessarily the writing, but he is writing something. And it seems to be part of the puzzle. Everything in a story contributes to the story. There are no just little details out there hanging out where John says, oh yeah, let me put something else in there. He wrote on the ground with his finger. No. Every detail is only in the story because it's relevant to the story. That's how good storytellers operate. No loose ends. So it's part of the puzzle that we have to unfurl. So what is the connection between what Jesus is writing and what they heard? Well, you know, the funny thing is, John's not going to tell us what he was writing, is he? He won't tell us. Which tells me that it's not what Jesus is writing that's important, but what he is doing that is important. Once we realize what he is doing, then I think we can make an educated guess about what he is writing. So what's he doing? Well, verse 6, he's writing something with his finger. And he didn't do it just once. He did it, verse 8, you know, twice. Again, he stooped down, he wrote on the ground. Why do I need to know that? Should that be ringing any bells for me? I think that it should. See, the Pharisees are bringing a case before Jesus regarding the law, the covenant, the law of Moses. How was that law received again? Do you remember? Exodus 31, we have the account. In Exodus 31, verse 18, where we will read about it. Exodus 31, 18, we have the reception of the Ten Commandments by Moses. And when the Lord had finished speaking to him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of testimony, tablets of stone, written by the finger of God. And this isn't the only time it's going to say that. Notice again, Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 10. Moses is rehearsing what took place, and he says, the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone, written by the finger of God. And on them were all the words which the Lord had spoken with you at the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly. God wrote the law with his finger. And he had to do it twice, by the way, because Moses broke the first copy. God wrote the law with his finger. This past semester, I had a student that ran into trouble, and they didn't take their final exam on time. And even though I had mentioned it in class, and I sent out an email reminding them to take it, somehow this student did not get the memo. And they sent me an email that was going through their situation, pretty panicked, right after, you know, the deadline was over, you can't take it anymore. Here comes this email. And among the things that they said, one of their arguments was, nowhere in the syllabus did I mention that they had to take the final exam. They were trying to use the syllabus that I wrote to get out of the situation that they had put themselves in. You know, they're saying it's not really their fault. It's my fault. I didn't include it. The only problem is, I know what's in the syllabus. You know why I know? I wrote the syllabus. So I know it because I wrote, and it was definitely in there. And whenever I was resolving the issue for the student, I pointed that out to them. They said, yeah, I know. I just overlooked it. Okay. In our scene in John 8, The Pharisees are trying to make Jesus contradict Moses. They're trying to make him contradict the law. After all, the law was given through Moses, right? Grace and truth, those were realized through Jesus Christ. That's John chapter 1, verse 17. And God didn't send the Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. John 3, 17. So the two must be at odds. And that may be how you think, grace versus law. The two must be at odds. But the law didn't come from Moses. The law came from God. He wrote the law. Jesus is God, is he not? He wrote the law. It's the character of God provided for his people who are to represent him before the nations so that all the families of the earth might be blessed in him, in that one. To contradict the law, he would have to contradict himself. But he cannot do that. He is the law of God in a man. He cannot help but be who he is. That's like if I went home to my wife and she says, "You're not acting very Caleb-like today." I'd say, "Honey, that is impossible. I am Caleb. I'm as Caleb as I can possibly be all the time." Your understanding of Caleb may need some adjusting. But I am who I am. Jesus is who he is. He is the law of God in a man. So he begins to write on the ground with his finger, and then he says, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." What is he saying? What is the significance of that statement? What significance would that have had to his audience? Listen again, this is Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 6. We read, "On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst." In Israel, you had a right to face your accuser. Now, you couldn't be accused from some anonymous individual hiding over in there in the shadows. You got to face them. You got your day in court. The accuser would face you, and if the charges were proven and it was a capital offense, they would also be your chief executioner. They would be the first hand against you, which means if someone was hired to be a false witness, not only are they being asked to lie about a certain individual, they're an assassin. They're being asked to kill this person in front of all the people. So the call to cast the first stone, that's actually a call from the law to proceed with the legal punishment according to the legal procedure for such a case. Now, the witnesses are to begin with the execution. But where were the witnesses? Notice the Pharisees' claim. The woman was caught in the act. And verse 5, Moses commanded us to stone such a one. Who's claiming to be the witnesses? They are claiming to be the witnesses. She was caught in the act. We were there. Moses says we're supposed to stone her. What do you say? Now, you may have noticed that the law also required that they bring the man that was involved. And where is he? Now, we're going to let that little detail slide. Evidently, they're not following the letter of the law. Close is good enough. They're just worried about trapping Jesus, so forget that. Man's nowhere to be found. But they are claiming to be witnesses. And Jesus says, if that's so, then start picking up stones. But what about the second part of Jesus' statement? He does say, let this one be the first to throw a stone at her. But before he says that, it's the one who is without sin. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. What does that mean? Well, I know how we understand that. I know how we use the phrase. I mean, that sucker is right up there with "judge not lest ye be judged." Judge not lest ye be judged. What does Jesus mean when he says this? When he used the phrase? And why was that phrase effective in ending this dispute? Listen again to the words of Moses in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 16. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges. He'll be in office in those days. And the judges shall investigate thoroughly. And if the witness is a false witness, and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he had intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. The rest will hear and be afraid, and will never again do such an evil thing among you. Thus you shall show no pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. We call this the law of the malicious witness. You know, basically, if you're trying to use the law maliciously for your own ends, then the punishment that you're trying to get brought on someone else is assigned to you. They are rubber, you are glue. It bounces off of them and it sticks to you. The same judgment. I wish we had laws like this in America. Now, we claim to have a justice system that treats people as innocent until proven guilty, and that guilt must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, that is far from reality. When it becomes politically, economically, or socially expedient, people are happy to bring up false accusations for personal gain. People like Jesse Smollett. You recall, he attempted to gain prestige by fabricating a hate crime in a time when being a victim made you a celebrity in our nation. Entire movements get co-opted by this thing, movements that may start well-intentioned. I think of the Me Too movement. Suddenly you have people making unverifiable claims from decades and decades ago. And while the courts may on occasion exonerate these people, the court of public opinion has already ruled, and they have already executed them. And despite being innocent, their name is now forever so associated with whatever terrible deed they've been accused of. Their lives are subsequently ruined. They are too hot to handle. They can't even get a job because of the false accusation. Think if there was a threat of receiving the same punishment for the accused crime, I think that probably go a long way to preventing people from bringing up false claims. You would purge the evil from our land. The people would hear and they would fear. In our text, Jesus is simply saying, look, if y'all are innocent in this deal, if the woman's adultery is indeed your concern, you know what the law prescribes. Do it. But you are malicious in this. If your concern is actually something else, if you're a malicious witness, you better check yourself or you wreck yourself. And he goes back to writing on the ground. Now we read in our text in verse 9 that when they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones, and he was left alone and the woman where she was in the center of the court. Why is it that the older ones took off first? I think they figured it out first. I think they saw where this was headed. You know, the youth, we can be very zealous. You know, we can think we're going to get this thing done. The old, they're a little bit more wiser. They're farther along on the road. They know the law. They see what Jesus is talking about, and they get out of Dodge. Eventually, the young ones catch on. They get out as well. They didn't come out of concern for righteousness. They didn't come out because of their indignation that righteousness was not being upheld in the land. They came, verse 6, so that they might have grounds to accuse Jesus. They were malicious. Now, what about this last line from Jesus in verse 10? He says, woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you? And she says, no, Lord. He says, well, I don't condemn you either. Go. From now on, sin no more. What is Jesus saying here? Well, you've probably heard it before. You know, Jesus changed the law. He overruled the law. He brought in grace, which trumped the law. So he changed the law. Is that right? You know better. That is not what is going on here. If not, then what is he doing? Well, how many witnesses do you need to try a case? Two or three or more. Where are the witnesses? They left. None that accuse her are left. Where are they? No one, Lord. Well, then I guess the legal and lawful and righteous thing to do is dismiss the case. So I look at a text such as this, a text that gets a lot of play in circles that want to abuse it and misuse it and use it as an excuse for why you don't have to represent righteousness. You don't have to observe godliness. You don't have to give a rip about the character of God. And I look at what Jesus is really saying, the one who is the character of God in a man who came to fulfill the law. And I ask, what about us? If I can't use the text that way, what does this text mean for me? Jesus didn't come to change the law. He came to fulfill the law. The law was always full of grace and truth. The character of God is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness and truth. A character that was revealed in the law, but it was realized in a man. The law put on flesh and dwelt among us. And while the law did condemn us all, Jesus did not come to condemn. He came to save. But he didn't save by changing the law. He didn't save by overruling the law or just waving a hand by it. He saved by fulfilling it to the letter and dying in our place so that by accepting the free gift of his sacrifice, we who deserved death, we might find life in his name. That is what this text has for us. Our gracious God and Father, how we love you and how we praise you for the love and the kindness that you have shown us. Most notably through the sending of your Son to fulfill your perfect plan that he might come and take the place of a people who had rebelled against you, that he might personally bear the stroke that we so rightfully deserve. How thankful we are, Lord, for the incredible compassion and mercy that we have received in him. How thankful we are, Lord, that through the words of the apostles, we may know him, and by knowing him, we may know you. How thankful we are, Lord, that because of what he came and did, serve you, we have the opportunity to share the good news of our King and the coming of his kingdom with others.